The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. My name's Andrea, for those of you who have not met before. Okay. So continuing an exploration around the Eightfold Path. In the last few times I've been here, we've been exploring the Eightfold Path. And the last time I was here, we began exploring the part of the Eightfold Path that is the Buddha's encouragement of how to engage in our relationships, how to engage in our relationships with others. And so this brings in a kind of the ethical component of the path. How do we speak? How do we act? What kinds of livelihood are skillful in terms of supporting us on the path? But before I dive into that a little bit more, I just want to recap a little bit and set the context of the Eightfold Path and why this is part of the path, why this aspect of being in relationship is part of our path. And so the Buddha really was curious about the possibility of whether we could live a life that would be one that has ease and peace, that doesn't have a kind of a conflict in the heart, a sense of struggle or suffering or stress. And so that was his journey. He set out to find out, is that possible? And in his practice, he seemed to come to an understanding that there's some functions in our mind, some habits in our mind that tend to constrict the heart, that tend to hold us into patterns, habitual patterns of reactivity that are motivated by greed, by aversion, by confusion. And he said that is really where there's a possibility for freedom, that we can find freedom from these movements of heart that kind of have us having a push-pull around what's happening in the world, a kind of a greed towards wanting things to be, have this particular outcome or wanting to get rid of things, so that there's this push-pull around our relationship with the world. And yet I do have to point out, each time I talk about this, I do try to point out that when the Buddha is speaking about greed here, often when we think about wanting something to be a certain way or wanting something to not be a certain way, we might bring into our minds, you know, well, what's wrong with wanting to change the world? The world is certainly not a pretty place. So what's wrong with wanting to change the world? And what I'll point to here is that the Buddha did also speak about a kind of a wholesome wanting, a wholesome desire, a wholesome shift or movement in the heart to act, but not out of a kind of constriction or hatred or confusion or a squeezing or a tightening of the heart, but more from compassion and kindness and love. And that there is a possibility to engage in the world, to act. Action is not only motivated from our habitual tendencies towards greed and aversion and confusion, but action is also motivated by compassion and kindness. And so this is an important thing to remember as we talk about the push-pull that the Buddha said is possible to be free of. And in fact, in my own experience, as I find my heart becoming free from the constriction around greed, aversion, and delusion, I find there's a more open-hearted responsiveness to the world that is not inhibited or restricted by ideas and beliefs that have been conditioned in my. You know, it's not coming from old habits and patterns. It's much more responsive directly in the moment to what's here. And so in a lot of ways, I think the freedom, the peace that the Buddha was talking about, the peace that comes from the release of greed, aversion, and delusion. That releasing of greed, aversion, and delusion frees up a whole bunch of energy to have an active peace. Or, I mean, when we hear the word peace, we often think of it being passive. Like, why would we do anything if we were at peace? But the heart that is free from greed, aversion, and delusion is full of movement that wants to act to alleviate suffering in the world. And so it's just important to remember that the freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion doesn't mean that we will not act. In fact, it seems to mean that we act more fully without having a lot of things in the way of that action. And so this possibility of being free from greed, aversion, and delusion, this is the freedom the Buddha talked about. It's not a freedom from unpleasant experience. It's not a freedom from, it's not that things will somehow perfectly go the way we want them to be, or that suddenly we'll have a lot of money. That's not the kind of happiness that the Buddha was pointing to. And yet the freedom that comes with being released from greed, aversion, and delusion, it's a deeper kind of happiness. And this is the pointing that that the Buddha has for us. And the first aspect of the Eightfold Path, the first two parts of the Eightfold Path, wise view and wise intention, kind of set this understanding up about what suffering is, and that freedom from suffering is freedom from this movements towards greed, aversion, and confusion. And that given that that is where freedom lies, the Buddha proposes that there are some actions, some intentions and actions that naturally follow if we are interested in following this path, if we are interested in finding this freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion, releasing greed, aversion, and delusion in our hearts, and finding that place of compassionate action, of responsiveness rather than reactiveness, then the movement towards that path results in some particular intentions towards letting go of the movements towards greed and aversion. And so the intentions to begin to explore, the intentions of generosity, of love, and of compassion, of non-ill will, non-cruelty, and renunciation are the three ways that they're framed in the suttas, that this supports us in beginning this exploration around where does greed operate in the mind, and how does it work, and how does it create a sense of stress and suffering right here, already in the present moment. And likewise with aversion, you know, how does that operate in the mind? And so the intention to do that creates a kind of context in which we engage in the world. So a part of the Eightfold Path is these first two, which kind of sets the direction for us. How, if we are interested in exploring this teaching, this direction that the Buddha offered us around the possibility of being released from greed, aversion, and delusion, which on the surface of it, when I, you know, first heard this, I thought, you know, that sounds, not sure what that would be. But then the Buddha said something like, this would be no mental pain or grief. It would be ease in the mind, peace in the mind. It's like, yeah, I can get more on board for that. That sounds like a good direction for me. So the intentions then lead us to want to engage in the world in a particular way, both in our relationships with others and in our relationship to ourselves. And so the encouragement is to, in our relationships with others, to explore ways of being that are not reinforcing these patterns of greed, aversion, and confusion. And then in our relationship to ourselves, so the relationships with others is in this section of the path called the section on ethics, which is wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And then I think of the relationship to ourselves being the last part of the Eightfold Path, which is looking at the cultivation of our minds, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. But these parts of the Eightfold Path don't operate independently, because the beginning, the orientation of a direction, the direction of the intention and the view towards releasing greed, aversion, and delusion, it begins to motivate us to act, both to engage in the world and our relationships in a different way, and also to cultivate a sense of that, well, how are we almost in relationship with ourselves that's in conflict? So both of those will happen simultaneously, and they'll support each other. So as we explore our relationships in the world, as we explore what does it mean to speak wisely, we are cultivating wise effort, and we're cultivating wise mindfulness. And in a certain way, we're also cultivating and supporting the development of concentration. And so and likewise, as we cultivate mindfulness, we become more aware of how we are engaged in relationship. And so these Eightfold Path factors, they interweave. One teacher talked about them as being eight strands, as if they're eight strands of a rope. They just interweave and support each other, and they contact each other. So we can't really say, well, first I'm going to work on wise view, and then when I'm done with that, I'll work on wise intention, and then when I'm done with that, I'll work on wise speech. We're cultivating them all together at the same time. And so tonight I'd like to explore in a little more fullness this aspect of wise speech. This area of the Eightfold Path is so important in our relationships, in our life. I mean, how many of us, I think we can all raise our hand and realize that at some point in our lives we have said something without thinking about it and then really wish we could reel that one back in. And that we said something just kind of thoughtlessly. Sometimes it's just thoughtlessly, or sometimes it's with a kind of an anger or a sense of hatred, and then we realize that hatred has just spewed out all over the place. And, oh, really wish I hadn't done that. And so this exploration around speech, it's pointing to how we can engage in our relationships, or beginning to engage in our relationships in ways that we don't add suffering into those relationships, that we don't add suffering into our own hearts. And in many times when the Buddha spoke about the ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path, he said, act in the way that does not cause harm to yourself or another or both. And in fact, he pointed in several places that when we cause harm to another, we are causing harm to ourselves. It may not be so obvious initially, but it is in there, that when we act out of an intention to harm, or when something happens and we cause harm and we kind of resist the owning it, you know, we're closing our heart down. If we're acting out of aversion or greed, already the aversion and greed themselves have a painful quality to them. And so the practice of mindful speech begins to help us to explore in relationship how can we begin to explore in relationship the ways in which greed, aversion, and delusion might show up in speech. Because as the Buddha points out, that we don't speak just kind of randomly. There is some kind of motivation there. There's a reason why we speak. And often when we engage in speech that creates harm or stress to somebody, there is a motivation internally that is motivated from one of these three aspects of greed, aversion, or delusion. And so if we're interested in releasing the heart from greed, aversion, and delusion, it's useful to be curious about what kind of motivations or what kind of speech would result from unwholesome or unhelpful motivations. So I'll just say up front that this practice of mindful speech is one of the hardest practices to do. Because we're so engaged in what we are talking about, you know, a lot of our attention is on the content of what we're talking about. Sometimes because of that, there's a loss of mindfulness because we aren't taking the time to step back and be aware of the fact that we are speaking, that there is a motivation happening. Our mind is kind of projected outwards into the content. We're kind of wrapped up in the content of the conversation and not so aware that we are having a conversation, not so aware that we are speaking and that we have motivations and feelings happening. We may kind of know that, but we're not clearly aware of it. And so it's really an extension or an expansion of our sitting practice, because in the sitting practice we have some ability in a way to like set content to the side when thoughts come up in our sitting practice. You know, we can recognize, okay, I'm not having that conversation right now, so let me set that to the side and come back to the present moment and take some time to explore what's happening now, having been thinking, and maybe allow the body and mind to settle a little bit. But in the midst of conversation, we don't really have that space. And so this is a challenging practice. So I want to start by talking about the Buddha's guidelines about wise speech. And then I hope to have some time also to talk a little bit about kind of mindful speech. How do we engage in the practice of being mindful while speaking? What I'd say is these guidelines, and the Buddha offered four guidelines on speech to avoid. He said we should avoid false speech, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. And I'll go through each of those, I hope, relatively quickly. And the purpose or the reason for avoiding those is that primarily those kinds of speech are motivated by one of these three reactive motivations. It's motivated by some kind of greed, some kind of aversion, or some kind of confusion. And so if we're about to engage in false speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, or idle chatter, probably there's one of those motivations at work. And so it's almost like we can use these kinds of speech to avoid as a mindfulness bell. You know, getting ready to say something that, you know, kind of separates me from somebody. Oh, okay, this is divisive speech. What's the motivation here? And so really I find that these practices are a good encouragement to look at what's happening behind the speech. I don't take these as just pure, like, don't do this, do this. Because if we're just taking it that way, oh, I'm going to say something harsh, stop doing that, zip the mouth shut, and we just engage in it as a should or a shouldn't, then we're not going to be curious about what's going on behind the scenes. And that's really where the learning happens. That's really where we can understand something about our minds. And this aspect of understanding our minds, understanding where these motivations come from, this is really where the freedom begins to happen. It doesn't happen by repressing a motivation towards saying something harsh. If we just simply say, zip it, don't say that, shove that down, basically what's going to happen is that those motivations are going to gain energy because they're being repressed. And so the curiosity is, again, about looking at, okay, ooh, wow, want to say that. What's this feel like to want to say that? What's the motivation? And so the looking, being mindful, I think that cultivating wise speech is a real support for mindfulness in daily life, because we have to in order to gain some of the benefits here, we really have to look at more deeply with mindfulness what's happening under the surface. One of my teachers, Saito Utejaniya, has said that he was practicing as a layperson before he ordained as a monastic, and he was practicing with the five lay precepts, which are the kind of the ethical guidelines for lay people: refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from creating harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicants. And then he decided to pick up, in the five precepts, only one of the aspects of why speech is in there, the aspect of refraining from false speech. And he decided to pick up the other three as kind of just guidelines for himself to refrain from divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. And he said at that point his practice really took off. And I can see that why that would happen, because you have to bring a pretty good amount of mindfulness to be able to notice those movements to harsh speech, divisive speech, and idle chatter in addition to false speech. So the first kind of speech to avoid, false speech. This is in the text. It's defined as speech with the intention to deceive. And so we may say something falsely because somebody has told us something and we believed them, and we pass that information on, thinking it's true. That is not speech with the intention to deceive. It may still have ripple effects out and create some harm in the world, but the intention there is not to deceive. And so this is just something to be aware of. In each of these cases, in these kinds of speech to avoid, the intention to create harm is a part of the part that we look at there. And so we look at speech with the intention to deceive. And so lying, this aspect of intending to deceive, it can be motivated by greed, aversion, or delusion. You know, greed, it might be motivated, lying might be motivated by wanting to gain some kind of a personal advantage. Or it might be motivated by aversion of intending to hurt somebody somehow, or to avoid some kind of repercussion for yourself. You know, the kind of lying in order to have somebody think a certain thing about you or something. So, and delusion, it can also be motivated by delusion, just the little exaggeration or making a story more interesting. Why are we doing that? You know, why exaggerate a story? You know, it's often because we want to look good in somebody else's eyes or something like that. And so, you know, that is in the deeper understanding of the Buddhist teachings around delusion, the desire to look good in somebody else's eyes it's a delusion that we need to do that. You know, that there's a kind of an underlying perspective that's just misperceiving what's truly important in terms of happiness, that the mind kind of believes in a deluded way that I'll be happy if somebody believes something about me. And so this the false speech can be motivated by any of these three. And so if you notice yourself getting ready to lie or to say something that's not true, really useful to check in what's going on underneath it. You know, I find there can be some gray areas in all of these. This one seems to have some gray areas. At one point I kind of took this on really seriously. And I found that my own message on the answering machine you know, contained a lie, which was, you know, I'm not able to take your call right now. You know, I might have been. I was screening my calls. And so I decided to, you know, it's like I just ended up feeling a little off around that. You know, so I decided to change the message. Just like, please leave a message after the tone. You know, so to look at these things, I mean, why say something like this? You know, I think often in our culture there's something like I found at times that there's this kind of almost need to explain myself. You know, why am I not picking up the phone? I have other things to do, or, you know, it's like, but I don't need to explain myself. I can simply say, you know, this is not, or I could just say, please leave a message. And I also found this in terms of, you know, setting up appointments with people that, you know, if I was not wanting or feeling my schedule was kind of full, that to say something like, oh, I can't go then, that left a little kind of odd feeling if for some reason I didn't feel like my own personal time qualified as being scheduled. You know, so you know, when I said, oh, I'm doing something else then or something, and really that meant was I'm kind of just staying at home and taking a break from being social, I felt a little off about that. But then I realized I don't have to say why. You know, so this was another part of the exploration. I found myself compulsively wanting to explain to people the reasons behind my actions. And that I learned that wasn't so necessary. So, you know, I could just say, that time doesn't work for me. I don't have to say why it doesn't work for me. I can just say it doesn't work for me. So this, you know, this can get subtle, and then it's also useful to look at the more obvious ones too. You know, the more obvious kinds of lies and some of the gray areas. Sometimes we have obvious lies in gray areas where we're lying in order not to hurt somebody else's feelings. You know, that's one that often people kind of bring up. It's like, well, what about that kind of a situation? You know, concealing something. You know. So the one thing to recognize here, I find this interesting in the exploration of the way the Buddha taught this. He didn't say that we always had to say everything. In fact, there's a story in which the Buddha clearly did not reveal some information to somebody. He didn't lie to them, but he didn't reveal some information until he felt like it was the appropriate time to reveal that information. And so the, you know, concealing information can be appropriate and can be a situation of not creating harm. And yet to actively lie to conceal information, that's something he did ask us to look at. Even to his son, you know, he said, you know, you shouldn't lie even as a joke. It's that serious. And so I, you know, I've started, you know, looking at that even, you know, that side. And yet there are really some very profound questions here. Like, you know, I just envision another kind of classic story that gets brought around this is like, you know, the Nazis knock on my door and I'm hiding Jews. And they come and ask me, are you hiding Jews? I hope I would have the courage to lie in that situation. I hope I would have the courage to that. I would take the karma. I would take the you know, the consequences of that lie rather than allow somebody to die as a result of telling that truth. And yet my understanding is that there still can be consequences of that lie. I mean, there are also consequences, wholesome consequences of shielding somebody else from being killed. And so there's a kind of a mix going on here. But, you know, there can be consequences to the lie as well. And so I think we do have to look at the whole picture at times. So there are some gray areas. And, you know, I think we really do have to look at the motivation. So in that case, you know, I would hope the motivation of protecting somebody's life would for me, you know, make it possible for me to lie to that person. So yeah, there's a lot to explore in this area around not speaking falsely. Oh, another piece around each of these areas of wise speech is that in engaging in these aspects of wise speech, there's a kind of the refraining side, so avoiding speaking falsely. But there's also the recognition and the understanding that as we do that, there are some wholesome things being cultivated at the same time. And so as we refrain from false speech, we are simultaneously cultivating truth and connection, commitment to truth. So that's also something to realize, that it's not just about avoidance, that as we avoid the acting on greed, aversion, and delusion, we are simultaneously cultivating some really wholesome things. Not only truth, but the releasing of the patterns of aversion and greed. And then there's divisive speech, which a definition of divisive speech is the kind of speaking in order to divide these people from those people. This is all over the place right now. Divisive speech it seems to be the mode of so much of our political conversations these days. So the Buddha encouraged us not to engage in speech that is meant to divide people, that is meant to create separation between people. It doesn't mean that we don't speak about, you know, truthfully about this person did this thing. But the Buddha, in describing this, he says, we don't say something here in order to divide these people from those people. And so it's really about this intention to create divisions and schisms and separation, the breakdown of community. And it's usually motivated by aversion. Although, you know, I've seen certainly these days, as I was reflecting on this, it does seem sometimes that people do that kind of division, sometimes out of greed, to keep things for themselves. You know, the divisions around, the divisions in the conversations around race and gender and sexual orientation seem to be, you know, to kind of keep certain things for certain groups somehow. So some of it may be also motivated by greed as well as by aversion or hatred. So again, recognizing when we are speaking in this way, when we are speaking intending to divide, again, thinking of these as mindfulness spells, this is something that is probably motivated by an unwholesome intention. So be aware. And the positive side of this, when we avoid speaking in a way that divides, is that we promote unity, we promote harmony, we promote community. And the third kind is refraining from harsh speech. And this is interesting. It's speech uttered in anger, and so it might have a harsh words to it, but it also could have a harsh tone. And so I take this to be both the harshness of language and the harshness of the way we say something. And so we might, for instance, sarcasm. Yeah, sarcasm. You know, you might say something that the words sound like. If the words were said with a kind and generous tone, it would be a compliment. But the way it's said is painful and hurtful because it's got that tone in it. So the it's not just about the language here, it's also about the tone. And so abusive speech, speaking in bitter tones and in harsh language, insult, rude speech designed to offend somebody, and sarcasm. These are all different kinds of forms of harsh speech. And so again, to be aware of what we're saying, how we're saying it. The flip side of this is the cultivation of connection and friendliness, as we courtesy, as we engage in speech that is not intended to harm, we move in the direction of speech that's intended to connect. Then idle chatter. This one is a little more challenging in some ways. And again, the motivation here is important to look at, I think, because so the idle chatter, and I actually like the Pali for this. I'll tell you the Pali for this one because it kind of sounds like idle chatter. It's sampapalapa. It's sampapalapa speech. So this is pointless talk with no communicating nothing of value. So that's the definition of mindful speech, of idle chatter. And monastics particularly are enjoined to keep their conversation to Dharma topics. They're given a whole laundry list of things they shouldn't talk about, like, you know, gossip from the well or talk of kings and roads and villages, and they're just basically encouraged to talk about the Dharma. And yet, lay people will have reason to have conversations about business, about politics, and also sometimes talk that may on the surface seem to not have any purpose. You know, like when we meet somebody for the first time, in a culture, we often start. We don't usually dive into the most meaningful conversation. It's not culturally, appropriate often, and so we begin a conversation like kind of almost searching for places that we have in common, or you know. So there's a lot of like talk a little on the surface, and yet the underlying purpose of that kind of conversation is to find connection. And so this is a place, again, it seems like a little bit of a gray area to look at the kinds of conversations that we have with people that maybe on the surface is not, you know, communicating much of value, but what's being communicated is under the words. Something about connection is being communicated under the words. Something about just the back and forth conversation is creating connection that can allow a conversation to move more deeply at some point. And so this is, again, something to look at in terms of the motivation. What's the purpose behind the speech? And useful at times to check in, because we can, in that kind of conversation, kind of veer into speech because, for instance, sometimes I think we end up speaking idle chatter because we're uncomfortable with silence. That we feel like it's not okay to be silent with somebody, even somebody we know really well. we may feel like, oh, this is uncomfortable. I don't like this discomfort. And so this is a speech motivated from aversion. Now, it may be that you're thinking that the other person is uncomfortable. And so, you know, it's interesting to just explore this. I mean, what is the motivation there? It can be interesting to just explore speech. Gill sometimes offers this instruction, explore speech in terms of, especially if you're practicing with or practicing speaking with another practitioner, can you improve on the silence? You know, is the silence actually communicating something of deeper value than a kind of foray into what can we talk about because it's so uncomfortable to be silent? So this is also interesting to explore, to extend potentially into the realm of just general communication. You know, communication in general, not just speech, but any way we're communicating through email, through whatever devices we use, through social media, and sometimes it's even easier to pause and reflect, what is the motivation of this communication when we're on social media? Because it's a little bit slower to get that social media, that communication out there. And so we have a little more time to pause and reflect, okay, pause, what's the motivation for this communication? I heard a story the other day that kind of, you know, speaks to this a little bit. It was a story about somebody who was in a parking lot and seeing a couple trying to load some things into their car, and the car was a little small; it wasn't fitting all the parts, and they were trying so hard. And this other couple kind of stood at a distance, people they didn't know, but they kind of stood at a distance, and were laughing at this, and you know, thought about videoing it, and you know, thought about, you know, what kind of hashtag could they get to put on this video, and how many hits would they get, how many likes would they get, that this really amusing, what kind of story could they put behind this. And so they spent about 10 minutes watching this, and thinking about this, doing this, posting this social media. Now this is a video, but it's a form of communication. But at some point in this process, the woman who was telling the story said she came to the understanding that this was not her better nature, that it was at the expense of somebody else. So it was you know, a little bit of harshness and a little bit of divisiveness. You know, can I benefit at the expense of somebody else? That dividing kind of quality. And so the process of, you know, sitting there thinking about it for a while paradoxically brought her to a point of recognizing, oh, this doesn't actually feel good. You know, so that pause of reflecting, what's the motivation here? Why do I want to do this? I want to do this so that a few people like my post versus this, you know, potentially, you know, given the what they call the 6 degrees of separation, you know, the possibility that couple eventually could maybe see this and actually be hurt by this. So the, you know, that person's kind of better nature came up, and they actually went up to them and said, can we help you? We have a pickup truck. And this was it just ended up being a whole different unfolding because that of that pause, basically. Now, admittedly, this time the pause was motivated by, you know, wanting to try to figure out, you know, how to post this. But still, the pause gave them the chance to see, oh, no, something feels off here. And so giving yourself a chance for that pause. So the practice of mindful speech, you know, these categories of wise speech, of refraining from false speech, from harmful speech, from divisive speech, from idle chatter, again, really looking at the motivation. This takes mindfulness. So we use these forms or possibilities of seeing, oh, I'm about to speak in this way, about to communicate in this way, taking a pause and reflecting. What's happening here? Do I want to follow through on this action? And the Buddha encouraged this of his son in his teaching to his son about ethics. He said, reflect before you act, before you speak. See if it's going to cause harm to yourself or another, or both. Could it cause harm? And if it would, then don't do that. So the reflection there, the process of reflecting, and I would encourage an additional piece of that reflection, what is the motivation? What is the underlying reason why you want to do it? Is it greed? Is it you want to look good in somebody else's eyes? Is it aversion that you don't like something? Or just confusion, uncertainty? So to observe this brings the practice into mindfulness. So practicing mindful speech. So this is really hard. Mindful speech is really hard. I think there's a couple of things that can support this. And one is, sometimes I talk about the kind of the process around bringing our mindfulness into really difficult terrain. And speech is one of the most difficult terrains to bring mindfulness into. So it's cultivating a skill. It's cultivating a capacity that is possible. And yet, it's a very challenging skill to learn. And so it's useful to begin in baby steps. It's useful to begin in more structured ways. You know, if we're going to learn a skill, like if we're going to learn how to play basketball, we don't start by trying to play a game with really experienced basketball players. We start by learning the skills of dribbling and shooting, and then we maybe play a game with a friend, and they'll be kind to us and won't push us over, and then we maybe start playing with a couple friends. So, you know, we build up to it. We build the skill up. And in a similar way, we can do this with mindful speech. And so the first skills are, you know, perhaps beginning with writing emails or working with social media, because there's a little more opportunity to really pause. You're taking the time to write something down. You can write and then take a break. Come back to it, read it. How does it land? What is the motivation? So you can take your time with it when you're communicating in that way. So this is a good place to begin, is in the realm of writing. And then I like to encourage picking a friend who is interested in practicing this and setting up a mindful lunch date. You know, encourage each other to practice mindfulness together. Practice mindful speech. I did this with a friend a number of years ago, and the first time I did this, and it was kind of interesting on my side, I found. So we sat down to lunch, we'd ordered our lunch, and we were sitting there waiting for the meal. And what was going on in my mind was, I was sitting there thinking of things, you know, things would arise in my mind to say, and I would look at them and it'd be like, no, not that one. Another one would come up and I'd think, nope, that's got a little bit of, you know, aggrandizement in it. Okay, not that one. Or, oh, no, that one's a little bit divisive. Okay, not that one. So I was sitting there ruling out things to say. I don't know what he was doing because he was silent too, but at some point what I said was, I'm sitting here ruling out things to say because they've got a motivation that is not so wholesome. So, you know, that was true. That was what was happening. And it just unfolded from there. But it just was really supportive to have a friend to have this kind of practice with. Pausing before you speak. Really helpful. Really, really helpful tool. In certain situations, this can be in a situation with somebody where you're practicing together. That's a really good way to do it. But this piece of pausing, I mean, while it's first I'll say a little bit about why it's so helpful. I mean, you know, if we just pause, if you pause before you speak, first of all, you have become mindful. If you can pause before you speak, you are aware that you're about to speak. And so mindfulness is there. And in that moment of mindfulness, you will probably know, you'll have an idea about what you're going to say. You'll already know. That thought will already be there. So you'll have an idea. And this begins to point out that we can know what we're going to say before we say it. You know, sometimes we blurt things out and we don't think we can know what we're going to say before we say it. But when we catch that moment about to speak, we can see that we can know what we're going to say before we say it. And in knowing what we're going to say before we say it, we have a little bit of a chance to evaluate, again, why we're going to say it and what kind of an impact it might have on the other person. So the pause gives us a lot of space to evaluate and look at, is this a skillful thing to say? In different conversations in kind of like the real active conversations, maybe in a business meeting or something like that, pausing before you speak often creates the conditions that you never get a chance to speak. I was actually in a business meeting this morning with Dharma practitioners, and I was feeling a little bit of this tension around wanting to interrupt people to get my word in, and realizing that as soon as somebody else stopped speaking, somebody was really right ready to jump in. It's like there were no pauses. And I was trying to be pretty patient. And at some point, this is the benefit of working in a Dharma environment, because this was a Dharma conversation. We were talking about a Dharma community and in development in a Dharma community. And at some point, the facilitator of the meeting said, "Okay, anybody else have something to say who hasn't had a chance to speak yet?" I said, "Yes." So, you know, it was beautiful to see that in action, that a facilitator could put that pause in. But if you don't have a facilitator like that, I've heard that there's a tool from nonviolent communication which allows a kind of a little bit of a pause in the room. But it's like you start speaking immediately by just saying, "Okay, so what I heard was," and then repeat what the person just said. So that both allows everybody to land with what was just said and gives you a little bit of a chance to reflect or have a little bit of a pause before you say what you're going to say. So those are a few tools for the practice of mindful speech. Another really helpful thing I found as I began to get more capacity with being mindful while speaking. And at first, actually, the very first thing that I went for was just simply, can I know that I'm speaking while I'm speaking? The pause before speaking is a great place to check into the motivation. But while speaking, it was so easy to just get lost. I mean, you can pause, know what you're going to say, and then a second later say it and then be lost. It's just amazing how fast mindfulness gets lost. And so the cultivation of the capacity to be aware while you're actually speaking that's hard too. That's a challenge. My first exploration was just around, can I know that I'm speaking while I'm speaking? That simple. Just, can I know that I'm speaking while I'm speaking? Right now, I know that I'm speaking while I'm speaking. It's particularly easy because I'm speaking about being mindful while speaking. The next level for me was to begin, when that began to get more continuous, I got more skill with being mindful while speaking. I began to be able to check in. Is there a kind of an agitation? Or is the heart at ease? And that was a really good clue in a kind of a fast-paced conversation as to my relationship with the conversation and my relationship with what I was saying. So if there was agitation, I began to kind of check in, okay, what's happening here? Maybe this is actually a time I need to pause. I need to stop speaking. So these are just a few tools around this. And it's time to stop. So I had hoped to let you have a little bit of conversation about this, but thank you for your attention.